Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 238 for April 18th, 2014. Live to tape from New York, it's Auto Line After Hours.
Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
So you may be wondering how the roof in the studio got so large. Actually, we're here at the New York Auto Show at the Javits Center. And while you're watching this and you think it's live, it's actually not live. This is actually the day before, so I just want you to know so you don't necessarily call in with observations, questions, or what have you. So I'm Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. With me is Neil Pollack of Yahoo Autos and John Krafcek, who is a board member of TrueCar, a longtime executive with Hyundai,
right.
Spent 14 years as an engineer at Ford, and he is literally the man who wrote the book about lean manufacturing and lean production, despite what you might think from other people.
Gary, I want to say I feel live right now. You said this isn't live.
You are live.
This feels live.
I can tell.
Neil, does this feel live to you?
It feels very much not live.
Not live. Okay. So we're going to talk about the show, but, you know, this, we usually start out this segment, we're talking about what's going on in the industry, and, you know, there continues to be roiling in the ranks at General Motors, and so I want to ask you, as a former executive, as a former car company executive, how important is having the right culture to address problems, for problems to be elevated, for people to feel comfortable that they can say, hey, we got a problem here?
Obviously, you know, critically important. And, you know, I think everyone in the industry right now is looking at the challenge GM faces and thinking to themselves, that could have been my company, right? Because
sure,
those things could have happened really in almost any company. And you could nitpick about some of the details. That I think the key opportunity for GM is to think of this as an opportunity, right? Because to the extent they still have some culture change to make, or maybe it's not evident to everyone in the organization, it's a great, great learning opportunity. Sort of the imperative right now is to ensure going forward that that part is fixed and do everything you can to make things right for the mistakes that have been made. I think they're on the right path.
So Bob Waterman, the guy who wrote with Tom Peters' original In Search of Excellence book, once told me that it takes a crisis for there to be cultural change. Do you believe that's the case?
I certainly agree with the thought that in crisis there was always great opportunity, right? I mean, when things are at their worst, that's when you have the mandate, the ability to make big change. We've certainly seen that in the industry at various points.
So if these guys pull this off and do it in a proper way, will this be instructive to every other car company, do you think?
Yeah, I could see this one has potential as a Harvard Business School case study, for example. Yeah,
uh-huh.
I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. We were talking last night that it's rare. We're all in this industry and we're all friends of a sort, right?
Sure.
We're all here in a way because we love the industry and we love the product and we love the people who serve it. And to see that on Saturday Night Live,
yeah,
was sort of strange. And chatting with Jason Stein about that last night at Automotive News, with the thought that, wow, you know, this is our world, but suddenly now it's being lampooned in popular culture and you know, 25 mm-hmm. million people are watching it or whatever, is sort of a dissonant thing,
it's a different thing. So Neil, I mean, as somebody who is a novelist, a three-time Jeopardy champion, who's a part of this culture,
I guess so. Whether I want to be or not.
So I mean, what do you see when Saturday Night Live is got Mary Barra's character on?
I mean, I thought that sketch was really funny and really, really spot on. And though I am, I guess, because I write about the industry, part of the industry, I'm still relatively new to it. So I come at it from more of a consumer perspective, and I think GM deserves everything it's getting. Honestly, I mean, you know, it's a problem of their own making, and you know, like I, it's I don't want it to fail, and I don't want anyone to be unsafe, but I feel like, you know, it doesn't matter to me whether the corporate culture changes or not, because, you know, the product has to change.
Right.
And that's the most important thing.
Well, ideally, if the culture changes, then the products can become improved. I mean, the thing that I think about is that, you know, if you look at the lean Andon culture of Toyota, that you are meant to pull the cord when something goes wrong. And when that was first brought to the attention through through Womack's book, I mean, everybody's like horrified. How can you possibly stop the line? You don't stop the line. You keep making stuff.
Yeah.
And so if you have an organization where it's okay to say something's gone wrong.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. You've touched on the key point. So all of these things happened in the context of a big vehicle development program. Vehicle development programs are extraordinarily complicated. You know, they're billions of dollars worth of investment, truly. I don't know the scope and size of the program that we're talking about, but it's probably well over $1 billion. And it's a 3 or 4 year endeavor. You've got hundreds of engineers from the OEM. You've got maybe thousands of engineers from the suppliers, all working to design and put together maybe 10,000 parts that need to hit every timing schedule. And if you're the program manager, a chief engineer, or whatever that program, the job is just extraordinarily complex. You have hundreds of change requests coming to you every single day. I mean, so I have a lot of empathy for the position that these guys were going through, the position that they have.
Because you've done it.
I've done it. It's a very, very hard position. And there's a mindset, but then there's the mindset issue that says, okay, when we're X number of months away from the start of production, there shall be no more changes. No more changes, because we need the design stable so that the manufacturing plant, supplier, and OEM can build the car with quality. So many automakers go through this phase. It's almost a bit of a fascination where they say, there must be no more change now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's always going to be change. There's always going to be change. And you have to have a system that embraces change, that has found a way to organically accept the change, even if it's late, because if it's a necessary change, you have to find a way to get it in.
Right.
You know, I see these equally sized or nearly equally sized mega corporations like Nissan and Toyota. They seem to be, you know, just from an observer's standpoint, a little nimbler and more able to sort of think forward and to adapt to a changing world. It feels to me like, you know, that what's going on with GM is a symptomatic. You know, they're kind of hidebound, and they don't seem to be leading in any way, and they're always playing catch up and having to scramble to find. Again, that could be a controversial thing to say in Detroit, but I don't know. It's my perception.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of perceptions, so what have you guys seen here? Since we're in New York, let's take advantage of that. What have you seen here today? You know, we're at the media preview. There have been a number of vehicles introduced this morning. The one that really caught my eye was Toyota has refreshed the Camry, but in my estimation, it's a new car. I mean, they basically, all new sheet metal, new interior, new suspension. They're keeping the roof, and they're keeping, I think they're just keeping the floor pan.
Mm-hmm.
And new styling.
Looks like a Camry to me.
It should. It's a Camry.
But I guess what I'm saying is that, yes, there's a new Camry, which, you know, is essentially just a car widget. I mean, they're going to sell millions of them no matter what it looks like. So, you know, to me, it doesn't feel, and I know it's newsworthy in the sense that it's a major product, but it's not breaking any kind of new ground.
Well,
whatsoever.
But your point that, you know, they could sell whatever they're making, and it seems to me that these guys are making a hell of an investment. I mean, that's got to be a very, very expensive change
for them
to do. And they're still selling exceedingly well. I mean, if you were in their position, would you say, yeah, let's redo the Camry?
I think it was a great call. I mean, if you look at product cadences, you know, there was a while when the Japanese Big Three had a 4-year product cadence that you could set your calendar by. And that sort of faded over the last decade or so to maybe 5 or 6 year product cycles. It's different now. I mean, the Sonata came out, the last-gen Sonata that's still in market was an 11-model year. The all-new car not a carrier or nut or bolt, although there's some powertrain components, comes out about 48 to 50 months later.
Right.
So I think what you're seeing from brands like Toyota is a reaction to that much shorter, or a return to something more like a 4 to 5 year product cycle.
So with the regular now standard approach being that after 3 years, 4 years, you do a major refresh, but it's no more than a front clip and maybe a rear clip and do something with the interior. But now what you're saying is that these are new cars.
Yeah, MMC are a major model change.
But right.
I mean, for the Sonata, it's an all-new car.
Right. You know,
it would be considered in any OEM's dictionary an all-new car. The Camry seems to be pretty close to it. I haven't had a chance to look very closely, but just to carry over roof panel, wow, that's a significant refresh. And don't forget, they went under the sheet metal for the 14.5 to improve safety and do even better on the IHS small frontal crash.
That takes some serious engineering.
Some serious engineering there as well. So, and I think that's pretty cool that Toyota's doing that, because that was a company that had a policy of holding aesthetic change for the MMC, for the major model change, and or even deep structural change like the crash. And the market's different now. It won't wait. Mm-hmm. So you have to get that in. So they got the crash stuff in, and they've got this major refresh in mm-hmm. in a shorter period of time than they typically would have in the past. Mm-hmm. It's good for consumers.
I mean, overall, I think you see at this show, you see major models being, you know, rebirthed, you know, the Sonata, the Nissan Murano.
And does that Murano look fantastic?
That is actually a beautiful car. And the Camry, I'm not seeing a lot of sort of great leaps forward maybe here. You know, there aren't new technologies, new hybrids, new electric cars. The things that I would like to see, the cars are very nice, but I would like to see the industry evolve a little bit more quickly, I guess. I pretty much speak from a consumer standpoint. You know, I feel like in terms of, I haven't seen the advances in fuel economy, alternative energy, and you can't really examine the sort of the new safety features at an auto
right.
show. But I'd like to see more emphasis on that, because cars are evolving very fast, and you wouldn't necessarily get a sense of that here at the show.
So in other words. And this sort of gets to the point that, you know, I had communicated with you about, like, what's not here, you know, and what does that say? And from what you're saying is that, at least to this point, no one has introduced a new hybrid car. No one has introduced a new electric car.
LA. At the LA show, you saw that. Detroit was all, like, big three bombast. And this is more just about large consumer models, a lot of them from Asian automakers, which, you know, it's obviously a significant part of the car world. But, yeah, I would like to see something that made me say, oh, this is new, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen that.
I was very astonished when BMW introduced the X4 today. They were saying that they're making an additional investment in Spartanburg, and it will be the biggest plant in the entire BMW network.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah, I think it is, I may have this wrong, but it may be the biggest net export plant that the U.S. has in any industry.
Possibly. Really?
Think about it. Right, that is BMW's export base, global production base for all their crossovers, and their average top line revenue per car is probably 50,000 or 60,000. Mm-hmm. Multiply that times the volume of that plant, it's got to be one of the biggest exporting platforms in U.S. industry, and it's a German company. It shows what a global world we live in.
This is clearly not a show that indicates that the industry is in trouble. You know
why?
Because
I see nothing but optimism.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying the show indicates nothing but booming industrial optimism, which is, I think, a little foolhardy, maybe, given the fact that the planet is heading toward implosion, and cars aren't helping with that. And again, that's what I would like to see. You know, there was a little bit of talk at the Murano press conference. You know, that's a crossover vehicle. That's not going to help the environment in any significant way. But they were almost embarrassed by it. They said, but we will, we promise, and we're going to, you know, be a global leader in electric vehicles eventually. You know, they're hinting that they understand that that's where the industry needs to go, but you don't see a lot of evidence of it here.
So, Neil, you would like to have seen more CEVs or something here?
You know, I would be perfectly happy sitting in an autonomously driven two-seater electric car. You know, I'll admit it. I'm not, you know, I'm like a kind of a
weird green.
They're going to be coming in with torches later to chase you out of
I'm
here.
I'm just
like
saying,
I would like to see more emphasis on that. And I realize that consumer interest isn't really there yet, but you know,
the road to autonomy is a really interesting road. I've thought a lot about this recently. If you think about it, imagine a world where 10 years from now, we could have a situation where there are only 10,000 fatalities on U.S. roads. Right now, there are, what, 35, 40,000, something like that every year. So somehow, magically, we could get there. And the way we got there is 100% autonomous vehicles. The whole fleet has been replaced. Not realistic, just a thought experiment, right? Could you ever imagine that world where 10,000 people died every year in autonomous vehicles? It's substantially less than today, a fraction of today. Could we ever get to that world? Yes or no, Neil?
I think that's absolutely possible because,
not today.
Because
it would be impossible.
Well, because you have a mix of autonomous and...
I meant in this fairy tale reality I was talking about, you can't get there because product liability would keep you there. It's okay if there are drivers who have issues that lead to fatalities. We're okay with that as a society, unfortunately, right?
I'm not particularly okay with it.
Well, it's happening.
But we don't want the machines to do it.
Right. What I'm saying is, you know, and half of those fatalities are under the influence, right? How are we going to get to that point? We need a whole new context to look at this that brings together governments and industry, media, big data providers, and figure out a way, because there is a way.
I would agree. We need a new context.
I got to cut you off.
All right.
Final word goes to John. So, John, thank you very much for being here today.
Gary, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with much, much more. Thank you.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern. AutoLine Daily, for the concise word on everything cars. Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
And we're back. We're back with Raj Nair. He's the Group Vice President of Product Development for Ford. And, you know, I was looking at your biography, and I've got to say that you probably have more experience in more places than about a half a dozen people combined in the auto industry. I mean, so he was involved in the 96 Euro Fiesta, Focus, Transit, which is coming to the United States, Mondeo, which we know as Fusion. He did engineering work on the Explorer, Expedition, F-Series. He worked at Asia Pacific, did product development, manufacturing, purchasing, quality, IT. I mean, It's just incredible. So you know everything about everything.
I know enough to be dangerous, I think. But I've been lucky to have been on a lot of great programs, a lot of great teams.
So here you are at the auto show, big 50th anniversary for Mustang. And I've got to ask you, how do you account for the success of that vehicle? Because the vehicle, I mean, so people can talk about the styling, and we'll have Maury Callum on later on. He'll talk about that. But, you know, from an engineering point of view, that has to be something particularly special for people to continue to want to get a Mustang. And they do.
Well, I think from an engineer's point of view, you know, the technical challenge of doing the next Mustang is always exciting and maybe even a little scary. But I think the thing about Mustang is it's much more emotional.
Yeah.
And that, you know, emotion we've had connected to the Mustang for over 50 years is the reason that it's been so successful, and it's become this icon, and to a large extent it really is the heart and soul of the company. And
Sure. We
like to say there's a little bit of Mustang in every vehicle we do.
Uh-huh. So a little bit of something is strikes me is being very interesting is that, so also today you guys launched the Focus sedan.
Yep, new Focus.
And announced that it will come with the 1-liter EcoBoost engine. Now,
Right. Now
that engine is already available in the Fiesta.
That's right.
Right? And so I looked and I saw that the Fiesta, sort of an apples-to-apples comparison, weighs 2,578 pounds. And the Focus, 2,907 pounds. Okay, this is now.
how can you possibly have such a small engine and put it in the Focus? I mean, and I know that you guys didn't, you're not having a dog out there. I mean, you really got something sure. that's going to, so isn't that impossible?
Well, not with today's technology, with EcoBoost technology, with direct injection, with turbocharging. You know, we haven't announced the full horsepower numbers of the installation in the Focus yet, but in the Fiesta, it's a 125 horsepower engine.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's got a very broad torque range. And so what you can get out of a 1 liter three-cylinder engine versus what we were getting even, you know, 5-10 years ago, it's just
amazing. So
you'd have
a four-cylinder engine and be lucky to get 100.
Exactly. And you know, it's not a trade-off for the incredible fuel economy you'll be getting. And in many ways, these vehicles drive better than those vehicles did 5-10 years ago.
And so how do you account for that? I mean, is there a secret sauce?
That's the heart of being an engineer, right?
Yeah.
We look at everything and think about how could we do that better. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what engineers do. And they never see anything that they're ever completely happy with. They're always thinking of maybe if we did it this way, it'd be better.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it always isn't.
Sure.
But, I mean, that's the nature of engineering. And mm-hmm. and turning those thoughts and dreams into reality. And, you know, I don't know how many times people said the internal combustion engine's dead.
Right.
Well, there's a three-cylinder, one-liter engine going in a Focus that says otherwise.
Yeah, that's completely unbelievable. Now, I got to ask you, and you've probably been asked this question a million times about the aluminum F-150. And I guess my question is, what gave you guys the confidence, from an engineering point of view, that that would be the right solution to address presumably needs for improved fuel efficiency?
It wasn't just about the fuel efficiency. The aspect of being able to take the weight out of the vehicle but maintain the capability, particularly in the high-strength steel frame.
Sure.
Right? We reinvest that back in the capability. Capability into payload, capability into towing, and many other attributes that get better
uh-huh.
when a vehicle gets lighter. Almost everything gets better when a vehicle gets lighter. What gave us the confidence is we've been working with aluminum for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, way back when we had our aluminum intensive vehicle project, our Sables.
Right, I remember that.
When Jaguar Land Rover was part of Ford, we worked with them, the mm-hmm. research and engineering group in Dearborn worked with them on developing their aluminum vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a lot of experience with aluminum already.
Sure.
And so it was still a big project, mm-hmm. but from all that work, not as big a stretch as maybe some people think.
So the scalability, the capability, these things are aspects that you're comfortable with in terms of making that change to aluminum.
Well, whenever you're doing a new F-150, it's always a very big responsibility. So I don't think we ever get comfortable, particularly a year where we're doing Mustang and F-150 in the same year.
Uh-huh.
But certainly our knowledge of aluminum, we've got a lot of confidence mm-hmm. in the approach we're taking, mm-hmm. particularly our tough truck standards. We torture test these trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing's going to come out of our product development shop that doesn't meet those standards.
Uh-huh.
So we're very confident in the capability of the truck we've uh-huh. designed.
So I think we need to wrap it here. So
great.
I want to thank you very much, Raj.
Thanks for having
me.
It was
very nice talking to you. Thank
Thanks.
You. And so as you can see, we're running this.
Oh, you're so lucky I didn't see you.
So we're running this live. So as you can see that we're actually having a little change here. And so
how are you?
It's informal. So we're having people talking to one another and old friends of the industry. And so I guess the point of an auto show is to be able to see people you've known. So this is Dave Zukowski, who is the president and CEO of Hyundai Motor America. And so thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And this is a big day for you guys.
It is.
That you rolled out with the 2015 Sonata. So tell us about the new car.
Well, we're having a big year. It was just Detroit that we were talking about, the 2015 Genesis.
Right.
And now we've got the Sonata. And they really are interconnected. What you see with Genesis is what we call fluidic sculpture 2.0. It's a little bit more refined, a little more elegant styling language. And then you'll see the same language in the Sonata. And going forward, you're going to see more of that mature styling. So as you start looking at our vehicles, I always think of BMW. You walk by a BMW on the street, and it looks like a BMW.
Sure.
You know it. And Hyundai's going there. We're getting there. Genesis was our first step, Sonata's our second, and the really neat thing about Sonata is we came out with just terrific safety and technology and information and all sorts of technology in that vehicle that we now trickle down to the Sonata. So now that's a car that's got technology in the midsize segment that's comparable to a premium segment, and it's something, it's a package that a lot of other people don't offer.
So to the point for the viewers that don't know, so the Fluidic Sculpture first version was in the 2011 Sonata when you redid the Sonata.
Correct.
And so basically what you guys did was you just took a market segment that had been fairly boring in terms of its designs, you know, middle of the road sort of thing, and say, hey, we're going to make this thing something special. And right. So you had the flowing shapes and forms that were part of that design language that has then been put to other vehicles, Elantra, Accent, and so on. So now you're taking that and refining it. You're taking it to a new place. Yeah. And so the Genesis, which is the upper, it's not as high as the Equus,
right,
but it's a premium car.
Exactly.
And has this new language. And now you're saying, okay, bringing back the Sonata, yeah, quick turnaround. And
So we were in a different spot 5 or 6 years ago, and we weren't known for our styling. And we were a great product, but really not that noticeable. A little bit generic, I think it's fair to say. So it was very important for us. Our brand metrics, when you look at consideration and awareness and opinion of a brand, are good and they're growing, but they were nowhere near where Toyota and Honda were. So we had to do something, and it's almost like you have to stand on a table and shout, hey, look at me, and beat your chest a little bit. So you needed to be a little polarizing. You needed to be a little special. We needed to prove, I think, to the segment that you didn't have to be an appliance to be a mid-sized car, and you could be good-looking, and you could be functional, you could have a great package, you could have great fuel economy and good performance, no compromises required, and it worked really well, and it really dragged our brand up with it. Sonata is very important to us. As Sonata goes, so goes our Hyundai brand image. So as the 2010 Sonata took the industry by storm, it took Hyundai up with it. So now, 5 years later, our consideration has grown, our awareness has grown. You can't make these quantum leaps all the time, because at some point in time you're going to leap off a cliff, right? So you got to be a little bit careful. So this is definitely what I would say is less of a striking car and more of a handsome car, mm-hmm, probably more sustainable. And so it's an important change for us. We think it's the absolute right change to make. We're committed to what we call Fluidic Sculpture 2.0,
right,
is the next generation. It makes a lot of sense.
So you have
for
confidence in what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And how you're doing it.
Absolutely.
And, can we look for Hyundai to continue bringing out new products as we go forward with the,
yeah,
sort of cadence and pace that you're?
Yeah. This is a product business, right? And we grew tremendously from 2010 to 2012 with great launches of big products that were well received and put us on the map. 2013 slowed down a little bit in terms of product cadence.
Sure.
And guess what? Our momentum slowed down a little bit. So
right,
this year, we've got Genesis, we've got Sonata, and in the next 3 years, what I said today is we're going to introduce more vehicles, at least 12, in the next 3 years than we did in the 3 years that marked our exponential growth. So we feel pretty good about where we're at right now. We feel pretty good about the direction we're heading and the product we have coming. So it's a good time, and we feel good about the market. Market seems pretty stable and has good long-term prospects, and we're going to be right there with the product.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. So
great to spend time with you.
Appreciate you joining us in New York.
All right. See you later.
So we're going to make the switch here, and next up is going to be Mark Fields.
Mark?
So as you can see here, what we basically have is this is part of the whole culture of the auto show that most people don't get to see, where people who have known each other, work with one another, get a chance to see one another. And it doesn't happen all the time, so it's a good opportunity for them to do so.
Hello again.
Mark, how are you?
How are you?
Good to see you.
Oh, it's good to sit. I like these comfortable chairs, too. Hey, guys. Make him comfortable so we just sit.
All right, so actually this man should need no introduction. This is Mark Fields. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Ford. He's a man who everyone learned this morning is a Brooklyn boy. Brooklyn, born and bred, and so he's back in his town. He's back with the Mustang. He's back with the Focus sedan, which is Focus nameplate is the leading nameplate of any vehicle on the planet. We've got the F-150 coming out. So basically, how are you going to exceed this, Mark?
Well, it's a busy year for the team. We're going to have 23 global launches this year, and 16 of them alone just here in the U.S. And, you know, it's all part of our One Ford plan, which is, you know, leverage our engineering talent we have around the world, use these common platforms, allowing to bring us, you know, more products sooner, freshenings, more significant freshenings like you're seeing with the Focus. Everybody's really energized. And if you look at our product pipeline, we have always said it's really important to keep that product pipeline absolutely full. And this year is another piece of evidence that shows
right. We're
backing it up.
But, I mean, it just strikes me that you know, clearly the Mustang has got to be America's favorite car. I mean, I know my friends at General Motors might dispute me with that, but
I agree with you, by the way.
And I thought they were very nice that Camaro gave a shout-out to Mustang yesterday, and that was a nice thing for the 50th anniversary. So, you know, you've got that car, so the icon. You've got the largest selling vehicle, the F-150, and then with the Focus, the global thing. So you guys clearly are, as the hackneyed phrase has it, hitting on all cylinders. But... So in your keynote, so Mark gave the keynote address this morning, opening up the show, and so he said you talked a lot about innovation, and you said that it's in order to have innovation, you have to understand the world's going to change, you have to anticipate consumer needs, and you have to anticipate how the changing world will affect consumers. So how do you, as the chief operating officer of one of the world's largest corporations, imbue that sort of thinking within the organization?
Well, I think very clearly, we've become very much an outside-in company. And what I mean by that is look at the business environment around us. What does that mean for our business? Look at the consumer, and what does that mean in terms of what they want out of their products, both the spoken and unspoken needs? And it just opens up a wide lens for us as a business to be very externally focused and not internally focused. Because when you become too internally focused, you start getting detached from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you look at some of the products that were, you know, very important products you mentioned here today, the Mustang, it's an iconic product of the company. We wanted to make sure, how do we take 50 years and make that product have a heritage, which is a history with a future? So what we've done with putting independent rear suspension in it, EcoBoost engine, make it relevant for today's time and today's generation going forward. Same thing with the F-150. When we started working on the program, it was about what did customers tell us. They told us they wanted great capability, you know, towing, payload, all that kind of stuff, and they wanted good fuel economy. And we said, okay, that's their spoken need. The unspoken need is they want really good fuel economy and they don't want to compromise on those capabilities.
Right.
And that's why we ended up looking at that and we came up with a groundbreaking product that, you know, we feel is going to deliver both.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just taking an outside-in view of the world.
And so the company clearly has changed. It's got a new direction. Now, there was one quote you had this morning, and I want you to explain this a little bit. You said, we can think like car companies or think like innovators.
Right.
And so it sort of seemed to me that you're saying this whole industry needs to move to a new plateau, a new direction. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Well, I think, you know, this industry is wonderful around innovation. When, you know, there's studies out there when people think of innovative companies, automotive companies, including ourselves, are on that list. But my comment was really around, as we see growth, and our view is the industry is going to continue to grow, if we think like traditional car companies is looking at that as just more sales opportunity. You know, from Ford's standpoint, we're thinking about being in the mobility business, which is not only about selling more cars, that's really important, but how do we be part of the solution around mobility, which means everything from semi to fully autonomous vehicles. What's going to be the customer acceptance around that, the affordability that they're going to want, the infrastructure that's going to be partnered mm-hmm. with, you know, the government and other parties to make sure that happens. But also at the same time,
the approach to owning a vehicle may change and will change. And I won't say it won't completely change from today, but you know, we're seeing car sharing services today. How do we be part of that solution? And that's what I mean by bigger, the mobility with a big M.
Right.
Not just selling more cars.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for coming.
Great.
Join us this afternoon or this evening, since we think it's tomorrow night. But so, Mark, thanks a lot.
All right.
Great.
Thanks. Good to see you.
So we'll be right back. So stay tuned.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
And we are back. Harlan Charles, is that correct?
Yes, Corvette product manager.
Corvette product manager.
Chevrolet.
And, well, Corvette, Chevrolet, I mean, aren't they synonymous?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So you guys had the big news here of the convertible Z06.
That's right.
So tell us about this, because I'm sure that our audience wants to know everything about Corvettes.
Of course. Well, this is a big introduction for us. It's the first Corvette Z06 convertible, with the exception of one that was built back in 1963. But in the modern era, I guess, this has really been a car that enthusiasts and people have been clamoring for. You know, we came out with the kind of the modern Z06 in 2001. And since then, that Corvette model has been very focused. It's high performance, fixed roof, manual transmission only. And so when we went into the seventh generation, our dream was, what if we could do with this new aluminum structure technology, we could do a structure that was actually stiffer than the fixed roof version. Mm-hmm. It's actually 20% stiffer as a convertible. So for the purist, you have that race car stiffness that you need, and also offer it as a full convertible open air. We have the coupe version with a removable roof panel, and now a full convertible, and is available with both the 7-speed manual and an all-new 8-speed paddle shift automatic. So it's really going to open up for people who want the ultimate Corvette supercar. It really is a true supercar convertible.
And the addition, usually convertibles weigh more, a lot more, than fixed roof cars. And you guys have been able to do this with just a minimal change.
Just a minimal. There's no change needed to the structure itself. The only difference in weight is for the convertible top itself. It's a full power top. It actually can be used up to 30 miles an hour while you're driving.
So you're rolling around along, and then you just push a button?
Just push the button, and it'll drop, or get caught in the rainstorm, push the button, and it goes up. And you can also use the transmitter to lower the top. Because, you know, Corvette drivers, we don't like to waste time. You know, we like to do everything quickly. Don't slow down for anything. So, and seriously, it makes the car very convenient to use. And, we noticed a kind of a change in the sports car market, where in the past people would say, well, I can have the hardcore performance car, or I can have this luxury GT car, you know. And now what we found is people really, you know, a lot of customers, we can still get either one, but a lot of customers want both. They don't want compromises. So what we're able to do with this new seventh generation Z06 is really give them the best of both worlds. It's going to be the fastest, most track-capable Corvette ever. We have at least 625 horsepower rating. Maybe, you know, we'll see how that ends up with the final numbers. 0 to 60 under 3.5 seconds. We've broken the track record that we set with the ZR1 previously, so it'll be the fastest Corvette of all time. And
635 foot-pounds of torque.
Right, you got it. 635, and then also having the option of having the convertible, having the 8-speed paddle shift with the automatic mode. It really is going to open up to more people to get their dream Corvette, really.
Mm-hmm. So, will someone run a Z06 convertible on a track? Are we going to see that?
Well, you might. You know, we were talking about, you know, back in the past, I mean, most of the sports cars were all convertibles. So you go back to the 60s and things like that. Recent years, though, you know, we probably, if somebody's a real hardcore track junkie, they probably would get the coupe, I would think. It is a little bit lighter. It's about it's about 60 pounds is the only difference for the power top. But it's nice to have that option. You know, there's other than that, there's really no difference. Like the car we have on display at our Chevrolet display, Has the what we call the Z07 option. It takes it one step higher. It has ceramic brakes, the cup tire, Michelin cup tires, which are basically race tires that are made street legal, and what we call our carbon fiber downforce package and ground effects. So it is a true downforce car without lift, which is very important when you have, you know, a lot of people talk about aerodynamic drag and CD and drag coefficient. But when you have this kind of power and this capability, you want to keep the car planted. Right. And that's from our lessons learned in racing, mm-hmm. that it's very important that these are true downforce cars.
So track-capable convertible. Well, I want to thank you for coming and joining us this afternoon. And
thanks.
Look forward to that car.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me
on your show. So we're going to make the switch again, and it's becoming a habit. You guys are all familiar with this now, and we're going to have Pierre Loying of Nissan, who is going to be coming on.
Good afternoon.
Pierre, thanks for joining us this afternoon. And so Nissan launched the new Murano today. So tell us your perspective on that car. Now, I know you're going to be somewhat
biased.
A little bit biased. And
So third generation Murano is a very important product for us. The brief for the designers was it should look like a show car. We unveiled a show car Resonance last year at Detroit Motor Show. If you were to put the two cars side by side, they look really, really close. So brief was exterior design, go back to the emotional design of the first generation, which we launched in 2002. But for the interior, capitalize on interior refinement, perceived quality, because this vehicle is the closest thing we have to a premium brand. We're cross-shop with Lexus RX. Mm-hmm. So exterior design, very emotional, interior, high quality, and refined.
So when the first generation Murano came out, it looked like nothing else out there. I mean, it just basically ripped the roof off the Segment and just changed things up. So you guys are now saying we need to get back to the position whereby people are going to stop and say, what is that?
That's what we believe. I mean, we have quite an extensive range of crossovers, each of them playing different role. I mean, typically the Rogue, very successful at the moment, and the Pathfinder are very much family vehicles, different life stage, one kid, early 30s for the Rogue, maybe two kids, mid-30s to early 40s for the Pathfinder.
Right.
Murano is very much an empty nester vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that's why everything's dedicated typically for four adults. You have the zero gravity seats at the front. We have the same at the back. You have this passage between the front and the rear seats that we call communication alley. Mm-hmm. You can recharge phones at the front and at the back. So there are a lot of details for four adults in the car.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you look at your brief for product planning, does the needs of the global market reflect the needs of the North American market, or are there differences and subtleties that you need to accommodate as you bring products to this market?
Typically, for a vehicle like Murano, North America is by far the biggest market. Mm-hmm. So we have, during product development, we have what we call the share of voice and the target market. For Murano, the target market is North America, which means that the other markets, namely Europe or China, will join the party, of course, but we'll be able to influence whatever maybe powertrain they need. But the focus target will be and is for this vehicle North America.
Right. And although the big focus here for Nissan at the show is the introduction of the Murano, you have also just recently brought out the Versa sedan. So tell us about the Versa sedan and what role you see that playing in the company's lineup.
So I said Murano is the closest thing we have to premium. Versa sedan is at the other extremity of the lineup. It's a very successful model for us. It's the most affordable vehicle available on the U.S. market, starting at $11,990.
So this is the most affordable vehicle, period, not just the most affordable vehicle from Nissan.
No, it's the most affordable, period, on the U.S. market. Knowing that, in fact, we're leaders in this affordable entry segment between Versa sedan and Versa Note, and it seems to click on with customers. We have quite an aggressive visual price, most affordable vehicle in the U.S., but in fact, the versions that the customers buy from us of Versa sedan are higher grades, and the transaction price we have compares, almost like for like, with most competitors. Mm-hmm. So we're leaders on this segment with Versa Sedan and Versa Note recently introduced, and we intend to stay in that part of the market as mm-hmm. well.
So as Nissan goes forward, as you begin to develop and release new products, I mean, what do you see as being the goal that you'd like Nissan to be known for?
But remember, first, we have quite a wide lineup. I think we cover probably 95% of the U.S. market. So
sure.
we don't need to add an extra vehicle. I think the portfolio that we have
right.
is very, very satisfying. So we will. We have some differences probably compared to other ones. We're leaders in zero-emission vehicles. I mean, Leaf now is picking up. Mm-hmm. We announced earlier we've sold 23,000 Leafs last year in the U.S. We've sold overall 110,000 Leafs worldwide, which accounts probably for almost half of the sales of electric vehicles. That will lead to autonomous vehicles. We've announced that in the midterm, by 2020, we'll bring an autonomous vehicle on the U.S. market. But it's not at the expense of the rest of the lineup.
Right.
We still have cars ranging from Versa Sedan to GTR Nismo.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that'll have to be the last word. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And,
thank you very much.
Good luck with the Murano.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful car.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to do the switch here. And we're... Hi.
How are you?
Good.
I'm Alana.
I'm Gary Vaslash.
Nice to meet you.
So we have Alana Tracy Bari. Am I saying that correctly?
You could just say Bari.
Okay, Bari. I'm sorry.
No. Just Alana Bari.
Okay,
is
Alana
perfect.
Bari.
Sure.
And
has to be facing this way, right, Chip? Okay.
You're good.
Okay.
Okay. So you're the product manager of a lot of vehicles.
I am.
I see you're the product manager of
3 Series, 4 Series, 5 Series.
Series 6, Series 7, Series.
No, 6 and 7, not anymore.
Not anymore?
Not anymore. But a bunch of them.
Z4.
Z4, X3,
X3, X4, X5,
X6. X6. Yes.
So, you have like the world's largest business card?
I have the coolest job on the planet, really. Oh,
just check, I mean, because
yeah.
it's just like all of these vehicles.
It's
So what does this mean that these are all your cars?
That means for the U.S. market, right. I manage the volumes, the pricing, the positioning, just overall life cycle of the car, as well as the long range volumes.
Uh-huh.
So it's okay. great.
So you're a very busy woman.
I am.
And here today, you guys rolled out with the new X4.
Yes.
So tell us about that car.
Sure. So we showed it as a concept several times. So this is the world debut of the X4. It'll be built in Spartanburg. It is a phenomenal car. It starts production in April, goes on sale in June, so early summer. It'll be available in a 28i model and a 35i model. 240 horsepower and 300 horsepower, 0 to 60 in 5.2 seconds on the 35i model. It's a phenomenal car, great to drive, very emotional concept.
Okay, so if people out there are saying, okay, I know what an X3 is,
right.
that is a crossover type vehicle. BMW doesn't use the word crossover.
We say sports activity coupe.
Okay, and
yes.
then they so they say, okay, we know what that is, we know what the X5 is, that's
yes.
a bigger
right.
version.
Yeah, sports
of that.
Utility vehicle.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the X4
yes.
is entirely not like those vehicles visually.
Right. So it has a so we launched the X6 model in 2009, and this is primarily the X4 is the X3 is the X6 to the X5. So it has a cut roof line. It's also different standard equipment, so you have sport automatic transmission, dynamic performance control, variable sport steering. It's more performance oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, 0 to 60 in 5.2 seconds. I mean, that's phenomenal for a light duty truck
right.
with
so
X drive all wheel drive.
It's hot
and
yet it's
practical.
Got utility.
Exactly. So it does. It's a 5-seater, but it's meant to look like a 2+1-seater. It's a great design, but it's also very functional. So you can seat 5. You have a good trunk space, comparable to the X3. It's really that cut roof line in the back that makes it what we call a sports activity coupe.
So if we were to go in terms of the sedans that are under your
yes.
umbrella, so
yes.
so what person would buy, let's say, a 5 Series and an X4? Or is that the sort of person you'd be looking at? Or is it either or?
Okay.
I mean, ideally both, but right.
Yeah, we'd love both. Well, we actually, what we did when we looked at what happened with the X6 when we launched that in 2009, it it skewed more male buyers, mm-hmm. More performance oriented. And when we look at the segment within the X3, in that you'd say compact sports activity or a sports utility vehicle, we said there's opportunity here. What we did with the X6 and the X3 actually skews, it's the most female buyers of any BMW model.
Really?
So we saw a lot of opportunity as far as how successful the X6 was in that segment. Mm-hmm. We saw opportunity in the smaller sports utility vehicle for that.
So do you think that it'll also be biased toward women and buyers, or
we
I mean, you want to sell them to anybody,
of course, and I mean, in the end, that doesn't matter. We actually think that there's more opportunity probably to skew more male on this vehicle, like we saw with the X6.
Okay, and so you're going to be exporting these around the world, so it'll
yes.
come from Spartanburg.
Yes.
And just go everywhere.
It does. It goes everywhere. I mean, we're really proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. is the only plant that produces the X3, the X5, the X6, and now the X4. So they'll be built in Spartanburg and shipped throughout the world, which is pretty phenomenal.
That is very phenomenal.
Yeah.
So we got to leave it there. So I want to thank you
great.
Very much. So
no, that was great.
Very quick, but
thank you. No, quick is good.
Thanks. So we'll be right back again. So we're going to make this change. And
there's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine This Week every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine This Week. You can't get more inside the industry. AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Looking at you.
And we are back. And so now we're joined by Murray Callum of Ford. He's
Hello.
The man who is in charge of design. So all of the Ford vehicles, this is the guy that...
This is the guy you can blame, yeah.
Okay. So now I'm gonna ask you about your drive here.
Good.
Which will be interesting. But before I do that, okay, Mustang, 50 years, many iterations, yet it has continued to resonate.
Yeah.
Some years very good, some years not so good.
Yeah.
But what I've got to ask you is two questions. One, what is it, from a design point of view, that has allowed that mark to be so popular? And two, will there ever be another car like a Mustang?
I think what makes it popular, I think what helped was the first car. I think the first car really set the tone for all the cars to come ahead. And because that was such a fresh sort of fresh look, a fresh sort of affordability for a great sports car, I think that's the one that really set the tone for the car. And you know, and we've done variants on that along the way, and some better than others, I think you would argue. But I think we've sort of really captured that again in the last two or three series of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great privilege to work in the car too.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
So, so I'm not saying will it be another Mustang, but will be
yeah.
another car that will have that will be able to come from nowhere,
yeah.
which literally the Mustang did,
yeah.
right? Is the whole culture changed? Has society changed?
Well, I think a couple of things have changed. I mean, I think we sold 1 million Mustangs in the first 18 months of the car. So I mean and there's been 9 million made. So that means, you know, and that's just for America, effectively. So there's probably been, you know, 30, 40 million Mustang owners.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why everyone loves the car. Everyone knows the car. We're talking about my journey here, but
yes.
we were talking to a lot of people along the way, and as soon as you stop, people bring out photographs of their Mustang or talk about the Mustang they owned or their girlfriend owned or something. So it's just this lovely sort of cultural sort of history about Mustang. Now, I noticed the Miata is 25 years old, and maybe that's maybe another car that could make it to 50, but maybe it's more global, but I don't think it's got that same resonance in terms of what it means to the history of the country, in a way.
Okay, so we got to do some backstory
yeah.
here. So the journey. So, you know,
yeah.
you'd think most executives who work for car companies, are lofty car company executives like Murray is, would be jetted here and feted. No, he drove here...
Yeah.
In a 67 Mustang.
I did, yes.
And Chris Svensson, who was on the show last week, he drove here as well. So these two guys drove together, you know, Chris in his car, Maury in his car.
Yeah.
And what happened was the weather
was snow and sleet, the whole 10 yards. So he has skin in his Mustang. This isn't just some executive talking. The second thing I think we need to point out is that once upon a time you led design at Mazda,
and you
worked on the Miata.
I did, yes.
So this is a car that you're speaking of with some knowledge.
Fun, some fondness as well.
Yeah,
so
and
I like
knowledge
that
and fondness.
Yes,
and,
yes. And I should be honest as well. I tried to get here in my 67 Mustang. Unfortunately, I got within a couple of hours, and a few things gave out. I think we bought three batteries and two alternators along the way. So some 50-year-old electrics don't always work.
But you know, the point being, you drove this car here and you did that.
Yeah.
And so what are we going to see from Ford design going forward? I mean, you got to keep the thing burning for the Mustang. You've got the F-150 coming out. You've got the new Focus sedan. Are we going to see the design of Ford continue to evolve?
I think that's really the main impetus of my job is really to, I think we're in a very good position from a design viewpoint at the moment. I think that, you know, what we really should not do is rest in our laurels, and we just keep need to pushing it, and I think that's hopefully you'll keep seeing progression and you'll keep seeing an evolution of the design language.
Mm-hmm. So from a car guy's point of view, that's what it's going to be about.
That's what it's about, what it looks like, and it has to look good.
Been quick, but thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
He's flying home, by the way.
He's
not driving back.
Thank you. That was quite short and sweet. Thank you. Is that okay?
Perfect.
How are you?
All right, so we're going to be making the switch again. So I guess I should have said, we'll be right back. But we will be right back. But no, we're still here, I'm told. So this is live, but it's on tape, so just so you know. So we're joined here by Michael Sprague.
How are you?
He's Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Kia Motor America.
Yep.
And so the big news here for you guys is that you are relaunching the minivan.
Well, we're launching a multi-purpose vehicle.
Exactly. Okay. So might someone like confuse it for
a minivan?
A minivan.
Yes. Well, the reason there's nothing mini about it, first of all. Minivans are only sold in the U.S. The rest of the world sells multi-purpose vehicles.
Okay.
And really, that's what this vehicle is all about. So all new Sedona, multi-purpose vehicle, meaning it's going to be targeted at families who are on the go and empty nesters who are very active and also on the go. It's just part of their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all the functionality, the technology, the safety. But there's so much negativism around the word minivan. We're just trying to change the idea of what it is.
Mm-hmm. So what strikes me is that, okay, the Sedona has been in the market for a number of years.
I think about 10 or 12 years, yes.
And yet, if we look at that segment, whatever we call that segment, we'll just call it
a minivan.
We'll just call it that segment.
Okay.
So basically we have Chrysler.
Yep.
And we have Toyota.
Yep.
And we have Honda.
And that's pretty much it.
Because you know the Mazda's got the small 5, which maybe wouldn't even count anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, do you look at this as being an opportunity?
Absolutely.
And how come? I mean,
because last year we sold 7,000 Sedonas in a segment that sold about 530,000. Now, some of them go to fleet. About 40% go to fleet. But that means there's still 350,000 people that go out every day or go out and buy a minivan. And we think, from a design standpoint, it looks very CUV-ish. So it already looks different. And we know that people, you know, don't like to drive a minivan. So why not drive something that looks like a CUV but has all of the functionality that a minivan has?
So Kia, with vehicles like the Optima, have been basically just knocking it out of the park when it comes to design.
Yep.
So you mentioned earlier that there was a stigma associated with this architecture of vehicle.
Yeah, exactly.
So have you guys applied the same sort of design thinking to the new Sedona as we would see in cars like the Optima?
Optima, or Soul, the K900. Yeah,
right.
I mean, this is the vehicle that really culminates the brand transformation, the design-led transformation that Peter Schreier started 5 years ago when we introduced the Soul. Mm-hmm. And this starts with the Tiger Nose grille, which has been on all of our vehicles in different iterations, and built around it so it looks very, very muscular, very athletic. From the front, so it looks different. It looks like when it's in the rearview mirror, you look and you see it, it's like, oh, that's a CUV behind me. And then it pulls up, oh, okay, so it's got the sliding door, so it's a minivan. But it, athletic stance, very clean lines on the side. It's something that people will want to drive versus I have to drive it.
So why is this person going to be interested in that vehicle rather than a Sportage?
Again,
so Kia... Yeah. Crossover vehicle, just right. No, for those of you fine. Who are not familiar with it.
Oh, yeah, the Sportage. So, yeah, so again, well, first, this is bigger.
Okay.
This is, it does have sliding doors for the, the functionality, the ingress, egress, which is so important. A ton of storage in it, because that's what consumers told us they wanted, all throughout and in the back. And so the Sportage is definitely targeted towards a different buyer, a buyer who doesn't need all of that.
Okay. So really... focusing on utility, but stylish utility.
Stylish, there you go.
And so you said 7,000 last year.
Yep.
7,001 would be good, right?
No, we'll send a lot. We'll sell a lot more
you
than
sell
that.
A lot more?
Again, it's three. There's 350,000 retail vehicles a year, and it's an interesting, really cool vehicle if you have to buy in that segment. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the competition, we say, this is something that you'll want to drive versus I have to drive it.
So basically, you guys are throwing down the gauntlet in some ways and saying, hey, we got something here because we're the challenger brand.
We are the challenger brand. We threw down the gauntlet with Soul. We've thrown it down with Optima, Sportage, Sorento, Cadenza, K900, really the ultimate. Here's a luxury vehicle from Kia, and we're here to play with the big boys. Mm-hmm. So that's to your point. We're a challenger brand. We continue to challenge kind of traditional automotive thinking, and automotive thinking has been that a minivan can't be very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
This can be exciting.
Okay. Well, Michael, I want to thank you for your time this afternoon.
Absolutely.
And best of luck with the new vehicle.
No
appreciate
problem.
It.
Thanks,
thank
Gary.
You. So we will be right back, and we'll wrap the show up. So we're going to make this change again, I think. Or not.
Autoline hits the road again later this year with live coverage from both the Woodward Dream Cruise and the Paris Auto Show. Join us first in mid-August on famed Woodward Avenue as we give you a front row seat for some of the slickest, sleekest, and at times silliest cars from the world's largest one-day auto fest. And then tune in again in October from the City of Lights itself for the first live look at some of the biggest reveals at one of Europe's top auto shows. That's Autoline Live, taking you to the world's biggest automotive events live.
Okay, so we started with that sign up there, and we're back down here again. This is the end of the show here at the New York Auto Show. I think that this has probably been the biggest Autoline After Hours ever conceived, but you know, this is New York City, so we had to have a big show with all of these guests. We really want to thank everybody for participating, taking time out, for having the opportunity to spend some time with us. A lot of you had a lot of questions, and we had asked you guys to bring the questions to us, but as you can see, that with this tight timing, we were incapable of getting to those, so I want to apologize for that. So I want to, you know, thank Ford for letting us be here, and again, thank all the guests, and thank you for watching. We will be back next week physically in the studio, not virtually in the studio. So until then, thanks, and good night.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.